I started out snowboarding and switched to skiing. And one time I was going down a hill and kids came past me with their snowboards and tried to run into me and called me a fruit booter.
a fruit booter?
Out of the way, fruit booter.
Yeah.
All right, welcome to Rated NA, the podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. And this is episode number 252. And I'm your host, Matt.
And I'm Scott.
And I'm Ash.
And we're all back together, and we have a special guest today.
We do. We're going to talk to Nick Pettit, who is the developer behind a new indie game called Neptune Flux, which is available now on Steam. It is a deep sea narrative adventure game. And it's on VR, and it's coming to PlayStation 4 as well. And we kind of do a deep dive into...
pun intended.
There you go. See what I did there? We do a deep dive into kind of like solo indie development and running a mostly successful Kickstarter, which is really awesome. So look for that later in this episode.
Yeah.
Cool.
And with the rest of our episode, of course, we'll talk about what we've been up to this week. We'll do a little bit of game news. It's been a light week because this is Thanksgiving week for us. And in our reviews, we will talk about Headlander on Xbox One, Doctor Strange and Fantastic Beasts. Remember I said beaks last time?
Yeah, I do remember that. I feel like you almost just said it again.
I know. I read the word and I remember what I said last time. And
I said beaks last time. Fuck.
Beaks.
I'll never say beasts again.
And Stephen Hawking, is that a documentary? Did you meet him in person?
No, that was a joke. Sorry, I left that in.
Okay.
The guy who played Stephen Hawking is the main character.
I see.
Sorry.
Yeah. Man, Scott will read whatever you write here. Hold on. Let me write something real quick.
Big dummy. Fart two.
Fart two, I'm a big dummy. I'm looking forward to that review as well. It's nice to be back.
This episode is brought to you by Loot Crate. Loot Crate December is going to be rad. I guarantee it. And you should get it. We don't have the wording yet. So go to lootcrate.com/ratedNA and use the code ratedNA. Get 10% off. They support us. You guys get stuff. And that is all great. So go. I'm sure it'll be something holiday themed and amazing. That's usually what they do every year. So
yes.
Check it out, lootcrate.com/ratedNA. And Scott, just keep your reading skills going. What have you been up to?
Thanks. Well, I don't need to read what I've been up to. I can just tell you about it.
What you do, man. Maybe you wrote it all down ahead of time somewhere.
I did write some of it down. And I can tell you, I think the next Loot Gaming has something from Dragon Age in it, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah. So just a little FYI for you there. But it's been a while since we spoke last. I know Matt hasn't been on in a while. But most recently, I played Headlander on Ash's recommendation, and I really loved it.
Yay!
So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was...
I feel like it, like, honestly, it was a game designed for you. Because the puzzles were, like, they were great, but they were a little... I got a little, like... pissed after a while.
Okay, sure.
Some of the puzzles, I was trying to be articulate, but I was like, no, I'll just say pissed. But I feel like the overall aesthetic of the game was incredible.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, you know, just, you know, as a reference point, I did not get pissed at all with any of the puzzles.
Of course not.
Yeah, so we'll talk about it later in the review section. I also played the beta for Steep. Are you familiar with this game?
It is a snowboarding game.
Yeah. So I played a lot of SSX back in the day. And so when I saw that Ubisoft was making a snowboarding game, which isn't, it's not just a snowboarding game, but I was interested, and they had a weekend, I think it was the weekend before last, where they had an open beta for the game. I'm assuming
a free running, time traveling, hacking snowboarding game?
No. What's really weird, kind of a left turn for Ubisoft, there appears to be no narrative in the game, which is...
Oh.
Yeah. So... In the part of Steep that I was able to play, all you really do is just find spots on this mountain and ride down the mountain and have fun. And
crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. And I know it's just the beta, so I'm not ready to kind of like make a determination about this game yet. But the thing that I don't quite get yet is I don't know what they're going for. Like if you're on a, you know, an extreme sports game spectrum, and maybe on one end it's Skate 3, which is, you know, a very kind of realistic skating game, and then on the other end there's SSX, where there's, you know, music and explosions and fireworks and insane tricks and stuff like that. I don't really know where they want to fall on the spectrum, and it's hard to figure out how I'm supposed to enjoy the game, you know, because I don't know, like, am I supposed to be doing crazy tricks? Am I supposed to be looking for stuff? Am I supposed to just kind of, you know, play more like a sim and just do stuff? But what they're doing with the game, which I think is really interesting, is that they offer you the ability to switch between four gameplay styles on the fly. So you can go to the mountain, pick a spot on the mountain to kind of do your ride or whatever, and you can switch between a wingsuit, a snowboard, skis, and there was something else, but you can kind of switch between all these different modes and try to go down the mountain in different ways or whatever, which is kind of cool. So it really just seems like they're kind of trying to create a space for you to hang out with your friends and explore without any kind of real, I don't want to say there's no narrative, but it's like they want you to kind of just make it whatever you want it to be, which is kind of cool. So I'm hoping this game is good, because there hasn't been anything like it in a while. But again, I'm still cautiously optimistic.
Can I tell you a quick story about skiing for real?
Yeah, for sure.
In the 90s, when I learned to ski, I started out snowboarding and switched to skiing. And one time I was going down a hill, and kids came past me with their snowboards and tried to run into me and called me a fruit booter.
a fruit booter? What was that?
That stuck with me for a long time. I don't know what it means, oh my but God. Apparently it's something derogatory. I don't know. It might be an Urban Dictionary. So if you're listening, send us a tweet and let us know what fruit booter means, because to this day, I don't know.
They tried to knock you down. Did they also tell you they were going to close the rec center too? Like, what the hell?
Oh, yeah. It was totally like from like Better Off Dead or something. It was great.
Oh, no. The community center is going to close.
Oh. Out of the way, fruit booter.
Yeah.
I didn't know there used to be a snowboard ski rivalry in the 1990s.
No clue.
Isn't that like the basis of, oh no, were there any snowboarders in, was it Say It Ain't So, the John Cusack? Was it Say It Ain't So? Which one's is a ski competition?
Oh, I think that's Better Off Dead, isn't it?
Better Off Dead. Yeah.
Yeah. One. With the $2 and Lane Meyer.
Yeah.
The old classic.
How weird.
Anyway, that's
cool. Yeah, that was a good story. I also tried Titanfall 2 multiplayer again, because I tried to control my rage from last time.
Man alive.
Yeah. I got real fired up that first time, and
I could tell.
Yeah, I just think my head was in the wrong place when I played, and once I had like a night to sleep on it, I kind of like gathered myself, and I was like, I know how to play this game, and I'm just going to do it. And it actually worked out pretty well. And I finished, in second place overall in one of the rounds recently. So I'm back on board, and it's really fun. And I, you know, again, there's a lot of shooters out there, but for what it's worth, the ability to have so much mobility in a, any kind of shooter is really fun, you know? So Titanfall 2 sort of scratches that itch. While they're maybe better shooters or more popular shooters, I just really like the ability to move around so much while you're right, shooting, and not just like kind of pogo jumping or whatever you do normally in a shooter. So that's cool. And then I think I talked about this on 251, but I did get back into Skate 3 for a while. And man, it is pretty much all I wanted to say is that it's still a good game. Like, it's just a really good game. It's kind of realistic. The controls are still tight. And it's a good example of a game that holds up over time, and it's backwards compatible now. And it's, you know, it was on sale with all the, you know, the announcement and all the Black Friday stuff. So, still a good game if you need something to play. Not that you do, because there's a million games to play, but, it was just amazing that it still held up after all this time. And the soundtrack is good as well. Oh, and the other thing that I should mention, I'm going to do this for my wife, is that the Gilmore Girls came out on Black Friday.
Yeah.
Did you watch any?
No.
I've probably never seen an episode.
I've never seen it.
Never seen an episode?
No.
Well, I watched the first one of the new series, and I will say it's very good. And
is
I'm
it?
Not, yeah, and I'm not just saying that. It's the, you know, maybe for people that don't know or they don't care, I just think it's interesting that we live in a world now where a show from the CW can get like 7 seasons, go off the air for almost 10 years, and then all of a sudden get, you know, a 6-hour miniseries,
right, just,
you know, through Netflix, which is super insane. There's like, there's literally nothing like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did Jen say it was good?
Yeah. She binged the whole thing on Friday and really enjoyed it. And is, you know, still processing it because, you know, it's like when you had to play Mass Effect 3 really fast and you're like, man, now I need to actually go back and play it.
Right. Absolutely.
It's the same thing. So she needed to see it to know, what happens, but now we're going back slowly and watching all of it. So that's really exciting too. So enough about me. How about Matt, who we haven't heard from in a while?
Hey-o.
Hey man.
Yeah. Man, where to start? So long weekend, which was nice. I did a whole lot of nothing.
That's great.
Yeah, it was good. We started watching Luke Cage.
Nice. Oh, cool, man. That's awesome.
I absolutely love it. Like, I like it a lot. Like, a lot more than anyone said I would like it.
Do you like it more, like more than Jessica Jones or Daredevil? Or?
Well, I mean, I got to get through the whole season. Right now, I would say probably Jessica Jones is number one. But God, it's up there. They're all really good. It's really hard. Really good. And they're good for different reasons, which is what's great about it. But I really like it. I'm digging it. I love all the characters. I like the music is like phenomenal in it. It's probably the best music from any Marvel series so far. It's like up there with like Guardians style, like good music.
Oh,
and
nice.
Then yeah, so we started that. That was good. I got a new phone. I got the Google Pixel.
Did you need a new phone?
We had like upgrades were up or whatever. Cool. I'm in that system where like if you don't upgrade, you're kind of just buying it. You could have just bought the phone originally. Like you're not saving any money by not upgrading essentially.
Yeah, so you're like in one of those like upgrade every year plan or every other year.
Yeah, like a year and a half or a year or whatever.
Sure, that's
and
cool.
Melissa wanted to get, she was the one who wanted to get Google for unknown reasons. And then, I was like, sure. So we both went Google. And yeah, I don't know. I'm neither loving nor hating. I feel like all phones are exactly the same now, except like
I agree.
iPhones are like you know, iPhones have like hideous interfaces and bad internal software, but like the greatest messaging system ever created. Mm-hmm. And then Google phones have like much more useful stuff, but the battery life always blows. I feel like I've had this 2 days and I feel like I've been like struggling to keep the battery going all day long. So.
Oh wow.
We'll see how that goes. I have 14 days to return it if I
yeah, don't battery thing it. would drive me crazy.
I was like, yeah,
that's,
it's
that's
like,
super important to me.
I don't know. I really was disappointed in the iPhone 7. Like honestly, that was the reason I was like, yeah, let's get Google phones because I just didn't like anything they did. I didn't like the fake button. I didn't like the no headphone jack. It just kind of was like,
oh yeah,
burned out on that idea that I have to like rebuy everything for Apple because they fucking make stupid
decisions. I don't blame
decisions.
You. I mean, that's why I haven't upgraded to the 7. I think everything they added was kind of a step backwards.
Or so. Subtracted? Yeah.
Yeah, they just remove stuff. I mean, the processor's better or whatever, but who cares or notices that anymore? I did keep one of the, we both had iPhones and I kept one of them for quote unquote dev purposes, but it's kind of my, if we decide all else fails and we hate the phones we're on, at least one of us can bounce back.
Yep.
I took part in Black Friday, sort of, but from my couch in my pajamas, which is the only way anyone should take part in Black Friday.
Apparently 10 million more people did shop online than they did not. Than they shopped.
That's
in
what
the
I
store.
Hear. Yeah. 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 A lot of people stayed home this time, which I think is nice. Still being super capitalist and spending money on things that we don't need, but but I bought a new graphics card for my computer and you guys already sort of know this story, but I'll tell it anyways, cause I think it's a fun reason why Matt usually sticks to consoles.
Oh man.
I bought not a top line. I bought like a mid-level, graphics card for my computer. And I knew I needed a new power,
supply
for it as well to power the card. Cause I knew what I had, like when I bought my PC, it was like kind of like under the guise that it could be upgraded later. and it was like marketed as upgradable, you know, but it had a card in it, but the card, it was like a 940 or whatever the low end 900 series one was. And so I get the new power supply, I get the card, and it's like, you know, from Amazon, so it's here in like a day. It was ridiculous. Everything was like here the next morning waiting for me. So I like bust open the box, I'm all excited, I sent you guys a picture, and I pull up in the case, and it's, and I'm like, all right, cool. I clean it up a little bit, and to their credit, it's super roomy, and there's tons of like available ports. Like I have three open memory slots, I have like four hard drive bays, a few different, I have two graphics slots, and like a couple of whatever PCI Express, all those kind of things. I'm not really in the know anymore. So I like get it all open, I'm looking at it, I'm like, cool. I unplug my power supply, I remove it, everything's pretty easy, you know. I grab the new one, which is all massive and looks like a Darth Vader power supply, and I, like,
yeah, totally.
I put it in, and I, there's like 70 cords that come off the new one as opposed to the old one, which had like two. And I'm like, all right, okay, let's see here. And I'm like, this doesn't match. And I'm looking at it, and the input for the motherboard is like 10 pin, and I have like a 24 pin. It's like clearly doesn't match, not even close to matching.
Yeah, that's the worst.
So I look it up online, and apparently, and this is heads up for anyone else out there that's looking, Lenovo, their whole run of like Idea Centers or whatever, the more upgradable ones that had graphics cards in them, all have these proprietary 10 pin power adapters in them. So I had to go to like some mod site and buy the one modded like adapter that'll allow the 24 to 10. It's, who knows? So we'll see. I'm either going to melt my computer from the inside out in a week, or I'll have a brand new graphics card and I'll be playing Overwatch, which I already bought as well with that.
Wow. I'm so excited. It was on sale, Scott.
It was like on sale, so I grabbed it.
I can't believe
you don't even you don't even have to shoot anybody. You can just run around and like shoot people with healing beams and like dance. You can just play and dance with us, man.
Who? Okay, let me ask you this: who do you think I would use in this game? Like seriously,
I didn't play long enough to know.
I think you'd like the character D.Va a lot.
Okay,
she's like this Korean pop star that flies a mech, but the cool thing she does is her mech explodes and she can pop out of it and call another mech down. So you can you're really mobile, you're really tanky, and you don't have to have like the super speed twitch aim, and you can do really well in a match, and her ultimate ability is like an atomic explosion, so she's she's super fun. You'd have fun with her, and I think you'd have fun with Lucio too, who's like a sort of a bard-esque healer. He wears inline skates and heals people with his with his sick beats.
This is nice. Just looking at the roster originally, I was thinking about using the there's like an angel, somebody.
Yeah.
I thought that maybe I could have.
I didn't love her guns, I think, if I remember correctly.
What is her name?
What's her name?
Is it
Sorry, I'm brain
Mercy?
Right, it is Mercy.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, Mercy has like a Ghostbusters kind of healing beam. And she can resurrect people, but. Man, if you played as her, everyone would love you because she's always needed.
Oh,
okay. Oh, you know, Pharaoh,
they added Pharaoh's really good.
Yeah, that's who I was. Yeah,
they added a 3v3 mode, so the three of us can play without anybody else.
Oh boy,
yeah. Just saying.
All right,
3v3.
Are we playing on PC? It's not
PC.
It's not cross platform, right?
It is not. No. Oh, okay. You buy it on Battle.net.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. So
think about it.
No achievements is what you're telling me, right?
I mean, you got to buy it in the next like day because I think the sale ends tonight. Honestly, not tomorrow.
Okay.
It was like the or what is the there's like three different versions. Why does every game have like 70 versions now? Why can't I just?
I know
this is like old man Matt complaining, but like I went to get Overwatch expecting to see like Overwatch and maybe like Overwatch Ultimate has everything in it or something.
Yeah.
And there was like three or four versions of Overwatch. Everything from like Overwatch to Overwatch Origins Edition to Overwatch Ultimate something.
Right.
I bought Origins. I don't know what that is, but hopefully that's the thing I need.
That's cool. That gives you a bunch of legendary skins that for the characters, but the thing about Overwatch is they've sworn since the beginning that if you buy any version of the game, you get all the characters and all the characters that ever will be released and all the maps that ever will be released. So that's sort of their MMO is to always give everyone everything.
Their MMO. And
they've stuck to it so far. So everybody's getting everything all the time. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. So I got skins. Neat. It was like $30, I think.
They're really good skins, though. They're worth it. Totally.
Okay. So I put Hearthstone on my phone because the phone has like crazy resolution on it.
Oh, nice.
And it plays really nice on the phone. Like I can see everything. It's super, super clear and everything looks really nice. But so I played some Hearthstone and then Titanfall 2. I finished the single player.
Nice.
And did a little bit of multiplayer with you guys. I still swear that if we do the capture the flag or the hold the base ones or whatever, that match is 1,000 times better than the like kill 'em all stuff, because the kill 'em all gets like way too insane, and if you go up against a team that's overpowered, then you're just
you'll
be screaming at the screen the whole time like we were.
We were really good at the old checkpoint capture.
That's what it is.
Right. I think the reason I didn't suggest that one is there's no bots in that, so you don't get the robots and the other grunts and stuff. It's just 6-on-6, I think.
They took them out.
Are not grunts? I thought there was grunts.
Not in capture hardpoint.
Oh
wow!
This time, yeah.
I can't believe they took them out. That's crazy.
It still feels like a hair more tactical though than just running around batshit crazy.
No, I agree. There's another one. There's another mode they added. What's it called? Anyway, there's another mode that's sort of in between the two that might work for us, because it does have bots and stuff in it, and it you actually bank your money in these special little money caches. It's really different. So
that's cool. So Ash, what have you been doing?
I played Titanfall multiplayer quite a bit. I'm still really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to getting back in there with you guys. Kind of found my groove, you know, like. I got to the point where I was sort of like Scott for a while, getting like a little agitated. And then I found you just have to kind of find the right gun that works with how you play.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while, I was just like running around with shotguns and just getting obliterated. And then finally, I found like a couple rifles that just like worked for me, and a Titan that worked for me. And then I was able to, you know, do a lot better. And I still never I've played quite a bit, but I still never rank like in the top two. I'm always like somewhere in the middle these days.
Doesn't it seem like I feel like it is easier to die. I feel like they made the game faster. Like it's easier to die. And I also noticed that there's a slight aim assist, even in
there's aim assist
competitive. Yeah, which is really surprising.
Yeah, I think that almost has to be, because if you're using the two analog sticks and you're moving that quickly, I think it would almost be impossible.
I know, but it almost defeats the purpose of running quickly, and which is kind of like,
oh, you think
it drives me a little crazy sometimes. Yeah.
I can see that. I mean, I think with any of these, I was actually talking to our buddy Drew about this today, because he's been playing a lot of Battlefield 1. Mm-hmm. And I had a very similar experience with Battlefield 1 that you had in Titanfall. I played Battlefield 1 multiplayer. I got my ass handed to me hardcore, and I put it down and I never went back. And I was talking to him about it, and he's like, yeah, you just have to keep going and dying a bunch. And then once you learn all the maps and you learn where to go and how to really control the terrain, then it gets a lot easier. And that's kind of how I felt with Titanfall 2. Like once I found out where everyone was going to be shooting me from and figured all the great places to hide, everything just got a lot easier and like a little less frustrating. But I still haven't gone back to Battlefield 1. And, you know, I don't know if I will, because I just had such a sour experience.
Yeah.
But other than that, games I've been playing, I got back into Hearthstone pretty big this month. My wife's playing now too, which is super fun.
Wow, that's cool.
We can talk about Hearthstone. I don't know what happened. It was that Twitch promotion, and Twitch did the promotion. If you have Twitch Prime, they give you like a Hearthstone character, and those characters are worth like $10. So I was like, oh, I'll download the character and put it in my old Hearthstone account. And then I just ended up getting back in, playing a couple games, and I was like, oh crap, this is incredibly fun. And they did something that I never played before in Hearthstone, is they actually added like these adventure packs. And so they have an adventure pack called One Night at Karazhan, where you actually go through a whole story and play against different bosses and get special cards. And it's just a really fun, immersive experience. And you know, I've always loved the World of Warcraft and all the Azeroth stuff. I've been a fan of it for, you know, well over, I guess, 12, 13, 14, 15 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing all the characters and everything has a bit of nostalgia for me. So I've been playing that quite a bit. And also that's something I can play with one hand on my tablet while I'm like half paying attention to my son and he's like breaking stuff, you know?
Sure.
So that's pretty cool. And other than that, we haven't been watching too much TV, but I am pretty excited. The DC CW universe shows are having their first big crossover this week. So they're crossing over Flash and Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow and Supergirl all in one big 4-hour story. starting on Monday. So I'm pretty stoked for that. And those shows have actually all been, all of them, all four of those shows have been really solid this season if you're into campy comic booky stuff.
News.
What's going on with Games with Gold? So they announced December 2016 Games with Gold lineup, and I think it's pretty good, sort of, and I'll tell you why.
So sort of. Yeah.
Well, we'll get into it. So on Xbox One, we're going to get the Sleeping Dogs Definitive Edition, which is a open world game, but it focuses a lot on melee combat, which is really cool. The Sleeping Dogs game, I think, is a spiritual successor to, I want to say, a game series called True Crime. Does that sound right?
Yeah, unfortunately, that studio just got shuttered.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Yeah, the studio that makes Sleeping Dogs closed, which is too bad. But I remember I played the prior game in the series, which I think was called True Crime. And I remember it being pretty good because Christopher Walken was a character in the game.
What?
Yeah, but, you know, it's your standard, you know, jump in cars, drive around, do missions, open world thing. But it's got like a fully realized melee combat system, so it doesn't rely a lot on gunplay, but instead you get into a lot of like you know, like Final Fight style gameplay, and there's moves and combos and stuff that you can do, which is really awesome. So that's a good game. The back half of December you'll get Outlast on Xbox One, which I think is a horror game, and on Xbox 360 you get Outland, which is an arcade title. And then for the back half of December, you get Burnout Paradise, which is one of those classic EA games that came out around that same time as Skate 3. It was totally awesome. So
yeah, Burnout was fun.
Yeah, I'm excited to play that. So the reason why I say it's kind of cool is that I'm very, very, very certain that the Xbox 360 version of Sleeping Dogs was a prior Games with Gold title. So, you know, if you missed the game when it came out, you know, for free like a year or two ago, you can pick it up again on Xbox. But I mean, honestly, I think it's
who publishes that? Do you know?
Square Enix. It's a Square Enix title. Yep.
All right. I'm just gonna throw a little water in their face. It's just mean to put that up as a Games with Gold title after the studio is shuttered, because the only reason why people do Games with Gold is to sell DLC.
Yeah. Well, the Definitive Edition includes all of the DLC. So
all the DLC.
Yeah, that kind of closes the door on that, yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, most of the time it's for that reason, or it's for, you know, obviously just for promotion. Mm-hmm. But to do it after a studio's gone means that the studio doesn't reap the benefit of it at all. It's like giving away their hard work, which is just, I don't know. To me, it just kind of makes me a little grossed out.
You know what came out this month, right? For November was Murdered Soul Suspect, which is Airtight Games, which also closed. And I think it's also Square Enix.
Yep.
Because that was the studio that made Quantum Conundrum and had who was in the studio? It was Kim Swift from Portal fame, if you remember. So same idea. Yeah, the game, I think, is available right now, at least for the next couple of days. Right. So
it's hard when you mix business with art, you know.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, and we've discussed both games at length in the past. So, but Sleeping Dogs is good and is still worth playing, despite the unfortunate circumstances around it. So that's the Games with Gold for December.
Oh, this one's mine.
Yeah,
sorry,
I didn't. Yeah.
I was like, I wrote this.
I did my reading properly this time.
Nintendo Classic sells out everywhere. I was one of the idiots who actually was trying to get one of these when it went on sale on Amazon. I was like waiting there, hitting F5, like trying to get one of these, mainly because I have this fantasy in my head of like this being the first console that my kid is gonna play, because it was really, really my first real console. Like, the Atari was my dad's, and he just let me play it, but the Nintendo and the Master System were my first console. So I was like, I really want my son to...
Like a weird flash forward where I can totally hear both of your sons being like, well, like the Xbox One or Two was my dad's. And like, I didn't like to play that much.
Yeah, no, it's very true. It's very true. But, you know, I really wanted to get a hold of one of these, mainly for nostalgia, and the price was right. But apparently millions of other people felt the same way, because the Nintendo Classic, which is priced, I think, at $60,
yeah,
it sold out everywhere pretty much instantaneously with no indication as to when it's going to go back on sale. And already they're saying that this is going to be like, this Christmas is hot, like Furby, you know, like everyone's going to stab each other for this. So I don't know. I was curious like, what your thoughts were on the Nintendo Classic. Do you care? We were talking before we started recording how it's dumb, how you can just get an emulator with all this stuff. But do you think having it all in a neat little handy package is worth it, or say you?
I mean, well, first of all, I think anytime Nintendo makes a product and it's sold on Amazon, I think the first 1,000 people, if they hit the buy button fast enough, should just get $200 credit in their account, because that's really all they're doing, right? Is just buying a product that you can turn on eBay at that point,
right?
I'm kind of sick of what Nintendo does with their like fake limited supply of products. We were talking offline about how now you can kind of wander into a Best Buy and find a bunch of rare amiibo that were otherwise unavailable about a year ago. So I think, you know, in your goal to get this for your son, I think you're going to be able to do that, you know, probably after Christmas, but you know, still.
Right, right.
Yeah, completely possible.
He can't play for a while anyway.
Yeah. But you'll, you know, I do think you'll be able to get one, and I think you'll be able to pay normal retail price for it. So
I would encourage no one to pay $200 for this thing is like the aftermarket value at the moment.
Right. And that being said,
go ahead.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you go first.
No.
Oh, okay.
That being said,
I'm going to go.
Waka waka. When it was first announced, I was like, "Oh, this is really exciting. You know, this could be cool to have." And then I looked at the game list and there's 30 games on the console, right? And you know, we're old. So I was going one by one through all the games and I was like, "I have played all of these games and I don't need this." I was serious. I was like, "I've probably beat, you know, 25 of them and have at least played the other five." And right, so, you know, and I probably own the original copies of, you know, maybe 10 to 15 of these games. So, it's a really hard sell for me, you know, and this is obviously, maybe I am the target market, but at the same time, I still have a lot of my stuff. So it would be hard to say like, "Oh, let me get this" or whatever. So there you go.
I think it's cool as a form factor, like, and as a piece of nostalgia. Like, I get it in what you're saying, Ash. Like, that's actually like a cool reason to buy it, I think. For me, like, the only thing that I think I brought this up on a podcast forever ago, I think possibly before this got announced, was I have like a bunch of Raspberry Pis that are sitting around, and I have an old, not super old, but for my 360, Street Fighter arcade stick.
Yeah.
And I've been like, man, it'd be really fun to just build like a little, you know, MAME arcade or whatever, have Nintendo on there, have all that stuff, and just hook it up to my TV. That would be really fun. So for me, it's like the price point's like a little too high for me to want to buy it for the amount of games and stuff on it. But I also think of it as like looking like the old Nintendo Classic and having the controllers and all that kind of stuff, I think is the bigger selling point there. So I get it. I think it's cool. I just, you know, it being sold out already is ridiculous.
You know, there's kind of crazy. There's another thing too, which is that I haven't seen, you know, any gameplay of the actual unit in operation, but
yeah.
But if you want to maybe make a comparison, let's take a look at like Rare Replay, which is a game that you can get right now on Xbox One for like literally $12. You know, probably when this comes out, it won't be $12 anymore. But I think the retail price at this point is $20, right? And it's not just the games that are included in the bundle, but I also think that Rare went back and made a really good presentation of all of these games with this kind of Rare Replay museum exhibit kind of thing that they do with all the UI. And they include documentaries and they remix some of the games with challenges that feel like more fresh and current. And you can play the full games as well, but they kind of add more to, you know, especially a lot of those really old games that, you know, predate even the Nintendo. So, I don't know. It's like, if all it is just the 30 games, again, it's a really hard sell for me. You know, if otherwise you just want to have, like, if just having the thing is cool, or, you know, you want to give it to your son, of course, which is a great idea. But I feel like I would buy this thing. I'd put it in my den, hook it up to the TV and go like, "Oh, well, it's just those games. Like, I've played those games."
Yeah. I hear you. I mean, I actually got a sort of a knockoff Nintendo console a few years back that has an HDMI out. It was like $10 on Amazon or something.
Oh, I remember you got that.
And I hooked it up, and I still have all my old cartridges, and I played it for like 2 days. And I was like, yeah, games now are better.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them were great. I was playing like old Mega Man games and like Iron Sword and stuff.
It's not upgradable. Like the HDMI thing is cool. And I know that there's two display modes for the games. There's like a classic mode and a modern mode or whatever. But,
right.
You know, what you had, you can play your old games with. That's exciting. This thing has 30 games on it. And seemingly no way to add additional games to it. So that's the other thing too, is that what if you wanted to play 5 games, but only 3 of them were there? Like, do you have to wait for the classic console 2 to come out with like the other games on it that you wanted to play? Like that kind of burns too a little bit, in my opinion, if you're just evaluating purely on what is in the box.
Well, I agree. And if you're a listener and you have an opinion on the Nintendo Classic, let us know. We want to know if you're going to get one or going to try and get one. So
yeah,
send
absolutely.
Us a message.
Absolutely. And I'm sure there are sort of other scenarios, not as hardcore fans as somebody like myself.
Yeah.
People that are like, oh, I had a Nintendo, but I didn't have these games or whatever. And then like, so just let us know. Like, what's your take?
Yeah. Guys, it's holiday season.
It is.
It is.
Do you remember last year when Cards Against Humanity offered you to send them $5 for nothing?
I know they do stuff. Was it the one with the poop? I remember they did one with
that
poop.
That was 2 years ago. Okay. They offered you to send them $15 and they would send you bullshit.
Okay.
And then in their questionnaire, it said, what kind of bullshit? And they said, literal bull feces is what we're sending you.
Yes.
And people didn't believe it, and then they gave them $15 and then they sent them literal bull feces later. So this year they did something else again, and I think it's pretty amazing, and it was called Holiday Hole. And Holiday Hole was a system that you could set up, or that they set up, where you would give them money and they would continue digging a hole on Black Friday until you stop sending them money.
Wow.
And I'm going to read the FAQ because it's really short and it kind of explains exactly what was going on, and it's kind of hilarious. So here's the frequently asked questions on the Holiday Hole site. It says, what's happening here? Cards Against Humanity is digging a holiday hole. Is this real? Unfortunately, it is. Where is the hole? America and in our hearts. Is there some sort of deeper meaning or purpose to the hole? No. What do I get for contributing money to the hole? A deeper hole. What else are you going to buy? An iPod? Why aren't you giving all this money to charity? Why aren't you giving this money to charity? It's your money. Is the hole bad for the environment? No, this was just a bunch of empty land. Now there's a hole there. That's life. How am I supposed to feel about this? You're supposed to think it's funny. You might not get it for a while, but sometime next year you'll chuckle quietly to yourself and remember all this business about the hole. How deep can you make this sucker? Great question. As long as you keep spending, we'll keep digging. We'll find out together how deep this thing goes.
Oh,
what
boy.
If you dig so deep you hit hot magma? At least then we'd feel something.
Wow.
So they raised, I don't know if you guys saw this, they raised $100,573 to literally dig a hole in the ground. And the top donors donated upwards of $1,000 to them so that they could dig a hole.
What are they doing? They're donating the money to charity, right?
No. Literally not. They're keeping the money. They like, that's what they said. They said, if you want it to go to charity, give it to charity.
Oh, they're not. Okay. So they're just keeping the money.
They were digging a hole.
Wow.
That's what they spent the money
that's
on.
That's horrible. That's so terrible.
Is it though? Or is it not? Because actually,
that's internet culture these days. They take something and run with it to the point where it's destructive. You know, I hate to be an old grandpa, but it's like, if something's funny, I'm going to throw $10 at it and see how far it goes.
But it's
well,
because
but
they're
me,
doing
is,
it. Like,
well,
not anyone can do that.
Right. But that's also, I think, to me, I think it's sort of a brilliant joke, because it's really them saying, like, how dumb. They do it every year. Every year they do something ridiculous and stupid. The money doesn't go to anything worthwhile. And then people give them money and they're just like, why? Like, they're pointing it out to you. Like, why are you doing this? Don't give us money. Like, one of the questions in the FAQ being, is this money really going to go to charity? And it's like, well, why don't you give the money to charity? Like, you're not required to give them any money. I didn't give them any money to dig a hole. It'd be insane. But like, it's just like, they're just pointing to me. It's like, they're very good at pointing out how ridiculous internet culture is and like what goes on with this kind of stuff when a joke happens. They're like almost like highlighting it in big, like bold yellow highlighter and saying like, look guys, this is ridiculous. Yeah. Stop doing this.
Ow,
and
my
then
balls.
They keep doing it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
So that's fun, right?
Totally fun.
I'm going to dig a hole.
Cool.
All right, we're back in our review section of our podcast, and the first game we're going to talk about is Headlander, which is a Double Fine title, which was published by Adult Swim Games and is now available on Xbox One. And like I mentioned earlier, this game came to me by recommendation of Ash, and it was very on the nose for something that I would like to play.
It's a hard game to describe, though, because it's very different. I mean, it's essentially a puzzle platformer, but it's just kind of just drenched in style, too, which is just really great.
Well, I would argue that it is not so much of a platformer because there's no jumping in the game. So there's,
it's true, because your head can fly.
Yeah. So basically, the premise of Headlander is that it's a Metroidvania-style game in which you play as a severed head inside of a astronaut helmet. And you have this ability to remove the heads of everything around you are like androids and robots. So there's no physical human beings. And part of what you're doing in the game is trying to figure out what happened to all of the meat space human beings. And you set off on this quest to figure out what happened to your body and to everyone else. So what you can do in Headlander is that you can remove the heads from pretty much any robot anywhere in the game and assume their abilities and use those abilities in order to progress through the game. And as you might expect in a Metroidvania style game, there's a very large map to explore and different paths to unlock. And they do something really interesting with how you progress through the game, which I really appreciate from a Metroidvania style game, which is, you know, in a lot of these types of games, they will show you a locked door, which you wouldn't be able to unlock for another 4 hours in the game. And the thing you need to unlock that door is, you know, completely on the other side of the map, and you have to do a lot of backtracking. And I feel like in this game, you don't have to do a lot of that, because what you do is all of the enemies are color-coded into different ranks and kind of different difficulty levels. And so a lot of the doors are just coded by the robot's rank. So if, you know, it goes from red to purple. So if you come across an orange door, you need to find an orange robot or higher in order to unlock that door and progress into the next room. So they do a really good job with kind of pacing what is normally very annoying in a Metroidvania style game. The thing that Ash was alluding to earlier, which is really exciting, is that the game is everything I love. It's outer space themed, weird, you know, retro futuristic vibes everywhere. Really bright colors. It almost reminds me of, you know, at times it almost feels like you're watching like
disco space,
like Moonraker, like super weird.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that whole retro future thing with all of the, vintage kind of color palettes and everything like that, that I really enjoy, with really good music. And of course it's Double Fine, so there's a lot of, subtle humor throughout the game. So if you've ever played, you know, like Psychonauts or Stacking, or
it has really good cutscenes too, which I feel like a lot of games are shying away from these days because they're very expensive, but they have these really cool like animated cutscenes.
There's very close up character animations in the cutscenes, which is like what you said is awesome, because you don't really see a lot of like fully rendered faces anymore. And this game spends a lot of time, as the name might imply, like looking at your actual face, which is kind of cool. The face of your character, which is neat. Instead of kind of doing that unlock system where the way you get new abilities is to, you know, find an object and that, you know, gives you the ability. There's only four of those throughout the entire game. And the rest of the stuff that you unlock is done through an upgrade tree. And, you just earn, the points that give you the ability to upgrade by finding, upgrade kind of like energy stations positioned throughout the map. And so you can kind of choose how to evolve your character in any way you want, which is really nice because they're mostly like combat abilities and not map progression abilities. So it just gives you new ways to fight and different ways to figure out what to do. Probably the other thing I should mention is, like you said earlier, the two main modes of getting around is to, you know, put your head on the body of a robot and open doors and fight and do stuff like that. Or you can actually detach and your helmet kind of thrusts around through outer space, almost
really
like
good physics on the flight too.
Yeah, it's like it's almost in kind of a weird way. It's almost like how you would pilot your ship in asteroids, you know?
Yeah, it has like a lot of weight to it. Like there's actual physics attached to the flight of your head, which I thought was really.
You
well
said
done.
You played the game at PAX, right? Or you got like a early like a review copy a long
Yeah, they
time
gave
ago?
Us a review copy, like right when it came out for PC.
Yeah, so. Yeah, and it recently came out on Xbox, and it's oozing with style. You know, if you like Double Fine games, you should play it. If you like Metroidvania style games, you should play it. And I would say that in my opinion, the puzzles are not they're not annoying in the sense that you need to do a lot of backtracking. Usually the thing that you need to help you get to the next room is no more than like a room or two away from you.
That's great. I like that a lot.
Which is really nice. And really what you spend most of your time doing is just figuring out like, where's the robot that I need? And then how do I move him around on the map in a way that gets me to the door that I need to be to? Because like I said, you can't jump. So a lot of the time you're just kind of trying to plot a course to get through, but it doesn't require you to be good at, you know, doing Mario style jumping or anything like that. There's not like floating platforms that you have to navigate. You know, the main challenge of the game is figuring out how to move through the levels. And then there's some combat too, and the combat mechanic is really good. And as you upgrade new abilities and stuff like that, it just becomes more fun. Like at a certain point in the game, you unlock the ability to basically do like a headbutt, which normally the headbutt would allow you to overtake another robot immediately. So normally what you would have to do is you'd have to detach your head, suck the head off of another robot, and then attach to the new robot. But then you get this headbutt ability, and you can just run into a room, headbutt another robot, and then it transfers your head to the robot.
That's great.
And it's just crazy stuff like that. And what you wind up with at the end of the game is a very sort of complex game, just because you have so many different abilities. But it just gives you a really just gives you a lot of really fun ways to play. And it doesn't feel hard. It just gives you a lot of different ways to fight and how to decide what you want to do with all these different robots, and it just kind of becomes like a romp towards the end with a lot of good humor. So definitely play Headlander. It's available everywhere now.
Awesome.
Yeah, I definitely recommend Adult Swim. Yeah, and we love Adult Swim as well.
We do. Yeah. It, you know, really quick about Adult Swim, I've been hearing a lot of other shows sing their praises lately, saying like, yeah, they went on from like, you know, making Robot Unicorn Attack to like publishing these incredible titles, and I'm really happy for them. They're a good crew over there. They've been supportive of the show for years and years and years. And I think what they're doing is fantastic. They find these little diamonds in the rough, and they show them to the world. And I think that's what game publishing should be about. And they're very nurturing toward their studios as well. So,
you know, Ian, and to that point, what I think is really great about it is that we don't necessarily actively seek out Adult Swim games, but they just happen to have the games that we like. You know, like I knew I wanted to play Headlander because you told me about it, and then I looked at it and I knew it was Double Fine. I wanted to play it, and only after I started playing it did I realize that it was published by Adult Swim. So they really, like you said, they really do have a great handle, I feel like, on picking games that, you know, would appeal to you know, to folks like us and, you know, a lot of gamers.
Interesting when this happens with some publishers. They, you know, you kind of look at publishers, at least I do, sort of like record labels.
Yes, absolutely.
And for me, like right now, and this is going to be a weird parallel that some people will agree with and some will not understand what I'm talking about, but in the 90s, like Lookout Records was where it was at for punk music, mm-hmm. at least for me.
Sure.
And they're kind of like becoming the Lookout Records of game publishing right now, because they get these just incredible titles with so much energy, and they're just, you know, showing them to the world, which I think is great. So
yeah. For sure. Cool. So let's talk about Doctor Strange.
Yeah. You want to do spoiler free, Matt?
Sure.
cool.
Yeah, I don't think there's a ton to spoil in the movie.
There's really not. It's an origin story, yeah. Which for once I'm actually okay with because
who reads Doctor Strange?
Right, exactly. Like, why
did you know Batman's parents
with
were killing you guys? Come on.
But I mean, you know, the short version is, you know, Doctor Strange is not unlike Tony Stark. Stephen Strange was sort of like this world-renowned brain surgeon who's this kind of cocky, egotistical jerk of a character. Mm-hmm. And something happens to him and he ends up getting these fantastic, I wouldn't even call them powers. They're not really powers. He learns to tap into magic, which is, yeah, I guess, the big first for the Marvel Universe.
It really is going into this fantastical element because they've always shied from it. They've even explained away Thor and that universe as like future science and not necessarily magic, where this one feels very much like they're like, oh, magic exists and this is what it is.
Yeah, so. Yeah, absolutely. And it oddly, it fit. Like, I didn't feel like with Thor, I was always freaked out that I was going to like, this is just going to be, I can't see, like originally when I went to the Avengers and I was like, how is Thor going to be in a movie with the rest of these people and have it work? And it worked. And like, it didn't feel weird. And I know I'm going to feel the same way about Doctor Strange in Infinity War, because I just feel like they've done such a great job of making him fit well into this universe. You know,
what I don't get, and we've talked about this a little bit before, is how do you frame an ability called magic? Like, where are the limits on magic in, you know, cause like I said before, Harry Potter learns individual spells and then uses those. But if Doctor Strange can just do magic, like what?
I find this really interesting that we're talking about Doctor Strange and that you have this question, because like 30% of my review of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is going to be related to this question.
Like, I mean, does he do like David Blaine street magic? Does he do like Harry Potter magic?
You have to think of Doctor Strange, I think, more in the metaphysical and more on the idea that there's like multiple planes that people walk on. Okay. So he's really like he's doing sort of fantastical like magic when he's on Earth, but it's not so much, I don't know how to put it, Ash. Like, it's not so much like shooting spells at people and like moving stuff around all crazy and warping things however he wants. Like, they talk about the problems with bending reality while in reality. So they have like this world called the Mirror World, which will definitely pop up later because it's actually a prison world in the comic books, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah.
And the concept of the Mirror World is that it's a world that mirrors ours, but is you can freely essentially warp reality around it, and it doesn't affect anyone that's actually in the real world at that moment.
Okay.
And then like really his big thing is kind of like altering the realities of the planes that he's currently walking on. That's like the ultimate goal of his thing is like being able to bend planes and reality at his own will.
Right. So, I think that like that the makes easiest a little more way sense for our listeners to kind of understand how his magic works is it's almost like unlocks in a game or like a skill tree in a game. Like, once he learns a certain skill, that kind of becomes part of his repertoire of skills and he can go back and do it, but he has to study it and learn it first. So like throughout the movie, he's like learning a handful of abilities that by the end of the movie, he's like learned and mastered those abilities. He can kind of call on them when he wants to. He doesn't have to walk around with a spell book and he doesn't need a wand. He's like learned and mastered those abilities, almost like someone learns Kung Fu, right? Which is where the spirituality and the sort of mystical aspect of the film comes in, which I thought was really cool. I mean, it's very different because, you know, a great deal of the movie is him learning and practicing and like taking these books that are forbidden and learning from these books. But, you know, I was shocked at how much I enjoyed it. I went in expecting literally nothing and I left being like, wow, this might be, you know, top five or top six. Like, this is a enjoy it. Yeah. Like, it was up there for me. Like, I felt like the fight scenes were like on par with The Matrix. Like, they were just fantastic to watch.
Yeah. You know? How did you like Benny Cumberbatch?
I didn't like him at all. I just don't get it. Like, I don't watch Sherlock. Yeah. I just don't get, like, he was okay in Star Trek. Like, I'm not like a fan of the guy. So like when he was okay as Stephen Strange, I felt like everyone around him was better than him.
I think the thing with him for me in this movie was that I've only read two collections of Doctor Strange books, and I've read those, and that's it. Like I'd never really read it super heavily growing up or anything. But I've never pictured Doctor Strange or Stephen Strange as a likable character. So in that way, I was like, oh, I actually think he was a decent fit. I do give Marvel casting credit because, like, goddamn, every time they pick a person that looks like that's who they've been drawing the entire time. You know what I mean? Like, it's really almost perfect.
Like, once he gets insane. That goatee, he's like photo. I mean, like, it's unbelievable. Yeah,
it's crazy. Yeah. So I agree. I don't love him either. I like him in Sherlock. I did not like him in Star Trek at all. But I generally don't like the Star Trek movies a lot. I actually thought this was one of his better roles, that I enjoyed him a little bit more in it. But I liked him more when he was the superhero Doctor Strange than when he was just the kind of cocky human Doctor Strange.
So, right. Really impressed, and I can't believe that I'm, you know, really excited to see where this character, where this character goes and what happens. Yeah, they did a great job of creating this extra world, and they reference the Avengers, and you can see Avengers Tower from his like office window, and there's little like hints and mentions here and there, and there's maybe some Easter eggs at the end where some Avengers may or may not pop up, but I think it's pretty fantastic that they're managing to pull off blending this world and this universe together for, you know, the impending Infinity War without us being like, what does all this mean? How can this guy know this guy? Like, once Infinity War comes out, if you've seen the other movies, you're going to be like, oh shit. Like all of it makes sense. We know we've seen all the Infinity Stones before. Like it's just genius. Like the fact that it's all working is genius. What happens after Infinity War, of course, is going to be interesting and kind of scary, because it's, you know, a lot of people are going to retire. It's going to be like a whole new, like, you know, it's going to be different. So
it's going to mirror our world. I liked it too. I'm really glad you liked it then. Scott, you gotta go, man.
I will, man. Eventually. I'm not a movie guy, but I try to get caught up when I can.
Have you seen Civil War yet?
No, but I have it queued up.
It's coming to Netflix. Netflix, December 25th.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
cool.
Netflix is picking up. They paid buku dollars.
Movies. All right, cool. I'll be there, man. Don't worry.
So I went to, this weekend, I went and saw Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the new tentpole for Harry Potter, new Harry Potter series that's going to be 5 films from what I understand.
Five.
Did you guys read that?
Mm-hmm.
I did read that.
I went and saw it at a theater. I only bring this up because of what you just said, Scott, but they built an Alamo Draft House here in Brooklyn.
Oh, gorgeous.
And it's really great. They have rules. So like you can't talk, you can't use your cell phone. And if you do, you get one warning. And then the second warning, you're booted from
the
theater.
That is fantastic.
So Melissa and I went. I'm going to couch this review sort of in two parts, which is I did not really love this movie. I came out kind of, I don't know, bummed, or it just wasn't what I wanted or maybe expected. So, but I also didn't know if I was feeling kind of the bad experience in the theater, and just I don't like Eddie Redmayne a whole lot. So
I don't really care for him either, man. It's weird. I just there's something. I've seen him in a bunch of films for years and years and years, and I don't know what it is.
This is like, you know, some actors, Eddie Redmayne too.
You just don't like some actors, and he's like one of those actors that just never really got me.
I think it's a totally a personal thing. Like I don't think it's a reflection on his abilities or anything like that, but it's one of those, like, he just for whatever reason pushes every wrong button on me, and I'm just like, ugh, God, I don't want to watch this guy for 3 hours. And then you think about like 3 hours times 5, and I'm like, I really don't want to watch 15 hours of Eddie Redmayne running around. There's that piece of it. And then when I left the theater, I asked Melissa, who's a giant, like 10 times Harry Potter fan than I am, did you like it? And she loved it. So keep that knowledge in your head while I talk about my problems with the movie.
Fair enough.
Because it may just be me, and it might not be everybody. Other people may love it. So the movie kind of kicks off, and it follows Eddie Redmayne playing Scamander, who is this guy who wrote this book called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. It's referenced in the early Harry Potter movies and books. It's one of their novels that I think, is it Hagrid gives it to them to read to study for class?
I want to say Hagrid.
But interestingly enough, the you can actually get the book as part of like a library set.
Yeah.
And it's got very little narrative in it. It's really a list of beasts and information about them. It's like a reference manual.
Yeah, I bought that for Melissa. Yeah. But so the movie has no real... This is the first Harry Potter movie coming out without any real background behind it. They're writing everything fresh for the movie. J.K. Rowling is not only an executive producer, but I think she was the screenwriter as well on it. So she's heavily involved. You know, same kind of feeling as before. This time, though, set in New York in the early 1900s, I think, was the time period we figured it out to be.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Dumbledore is somewhere around like 30 years old, and there's a bad guy on the loose named Grindelwald, who is Dumbledore's ex-friend. You can kind of go read up on this in some of the Harry Potter lore. But he's on the loose in what I thought was England in the beginning, and then there's rumors of him being in America, and then essentially it starts off with Eddie Redmayne with those like kind of news flashes happening. And then Eddie Redmayne comes to the shores of America. He's got a suitcase on him full of animals and or creatures, and you know, hijinks ensue.
Yep.
There's I think the main issues I had with it right off the bat were there appears to be like three plot lines, and not like subplots, but like three main plot lines running through this. You've got Eddie Redmayne and his box of creatures. You've got a weird like anti-witch. It's called like Salem, New Salem, I think is what they call it.
Okay.
And it's this woman who is handing out flyers and going after witches that she thinks are real, and then the country at large is sort of still unaware of them and sort of denying them, but she says they're back, and of course they are. And so there's that plot line of her like going after witches, and then there's a third plot line of this search for this like powerful child. The head of the police is like having this sort of background search to find this really powerful child, and so there's these three main plot lines kind of running, and then there's some subplots, and there's like a love story or two, and there's just a lot going on in the movie. If the goals were like the size of what I think they were, then I understand maybe why they split it up into, I guess, five, which seems excessive, but five movies.
Yeah.
But still, with that knowledge, I'm like, well, why'd they jam so much in this one? Like, is each movie going to have like five plot lines going on at any one point in time?
Sounds very dense.
It was really dense. The thing that I talked to Melissa about afterwards that she was like, oh yeah, it did sort of seem like that, is that it felt like the writer, whether it was J.K. Rowling or one of the other writers that might have been on it, wrote a very dark story, like a very dense, dark, heavy story. And then the studio went, whoa, like, put a dark Harry Potter out there. Like, that's not going to happen.
Not for number one.
You need to punch it up. So there's a lot of like weird like pratfally humor in it, like just really goofy, like over the top humor that happens inside of it to get laughs, and some of it's done very well and very funny, but it makes for this super uneven story where it's like lighthearted but about like heavy dark things. I walked out of it, I think, just feeling sort of confused. Like, it just didn't feel like the movie knew what it was doing. That being said, the new world is kind of interesting. It's neat to see this magical world happening outside of England and kind of not having that built in, not nostalgia, but that built in sort of feeling, I guess, that old England kind of give you, you know?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I got it.
It's like, while it's old USA, you know, old New York is not the same as like an old British castle that all the kids are running around.
No,
like that's,
of course not.
Those have two very different feelings to them. So that was really interesting. I could see that building into something really fun. And then the thing I was going to talk about a lot, but I've already talked so much, is that, Scott, you pointed this out, and it's something I've always felt is true. I always felt like Harry Potter lived in a very kind of rule-based magic world.
Yes.
Where it was like,
you learn spells.
Yeah. And you cast a spell and you do all this stuff. And then like, if you were super advanced, you could maybe cast without saying anything, but you still usually had your wand like there was still like stuff built around it to be like, you couldn't just make whatever you want.
It was very clear. It was extremely clear. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, and I talked to Melissa about it and she was like, no, stuff happens in the movies and the books that, that doesn't seem explainable. And I was like what? And she said, well, remember when they flew the car? She's like, no one saw them. And then we've actually been rewatching all the movies today. And we got to that scene and there's like a newspaper article about car scene, you know, flying through the sky. Like mm-hmm. a lot of people saw them and it was like a thing. And she was like, oh, okay. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I always felt like those movies explained the rules and the stuff that was going on around it. This movie, like, holy cow, just like stuff, just they just do whatever they want with magic. There doesn't seem to be, there's no spells cast at all. And maybe it's the nature of it all being adults who know magic already.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But there's no, like, rarely do they announce a spell. One of the bad guys uses what is essentially force powers while casting with his wand. Like, he's like using his right hand to just like push things left and right wherever he wants. And still like casting spells at people with his wand and his left hand. So there's just like a lot of that going on. And then there's a huge scene that I can't really describe because it kind of, it would spoil stuff, but it gets real confusing at a certain point as to what magic can and cannot do. Like oh, there are hundreds of wizards running around doing something and you can't, like, I don't even know how it just makes no sense. Honestly, at the end of the movie, you're just like, I don't know how this is, would even be sort of explainable in the magic world that Harry Potter lived in. Hmm. So
it's actually is really intriguing. It makes me want to see it more just because I don't know. I'm curious. Like I was worried about the Eddie Redmayne thing and I'm kind of glad you feel the same way.
Yeah, he's
sometimes I just feel like a dick. I'm just, but like most of the films I see him in, I'm kind of like shrug, but, I don't know. It's interesting. It's going to be interesting going back because it's like, you know, it's a world that that most of us care a lot about and for one reason or another. And it's very interesting to go back and have like, in a lot of ways, it's a lot like Rogue One, you know, it's like this different take on a beloved franchise. So,
yeah, I don't know. There you go. Was that a review? Did that make sense? Was it too long?
It did. No, it made me want to see it more actually.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll see it either way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why not?
You can't not. It's Harry Potter. You can't not see it, right? Like, you're going to see it.
Right, so. Of course. In the next four after it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Let's see. So, with that, why don't we go into our interview with Nick Pettit, the developer for the game Neptune Flux, which is now available on Steam and will soon be available on PS4 and PlayStation VR. And like we mentioned at the top of the show, it's just a really great conversation where we do a deep dive into really what it takes to put a game out, including, you know, getting funding through Kickstarter, overcoming the challenges, managing your Kickstarter and trying to actually make your game at the same time. And then, you know, all the things that come along with getting it onto Steam and, you know, collecting feedback and putting a beta out and just kind of trying to juggle everything at once. So enjoy this interview and then we'll see you on the other side. Cool. So we are here with Nick Pettit, who is the person of the hour behind the game Neptune Flux. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So for our listeners that may not be familiar with the game, why don't you sort of give us an introduction to yourself and sort of the elevator pitch for Neptune Flux?
Sure. So my name is Nick Pettit, and I am a teacher at an online school called Treehouse. So we teach how to make websites, apps, and VR applications. So I teach virtual reality stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
And by night and by weekend, I work on video games. And for the past couple of years, I've been working on this game called Neptune Flux. And it's a deep sea VR adventure game. And it's on Steam right now. You can play with or without a VR headset. But yeah, if you like adventure games like, I don't know, like Gone Home or Firewatch or Myst, it's kind of in that same vein.
Yeah, awesome.
We are big fans of those games.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And it's awesome that, you know, obviously, like, what, you know, we do this as sort of our nighttime job and, you know, you do this. You know, Neptune Flux is also a project that came out of your nighttime job. So that's really awesome as well. And actually, you ran a Kickstarter for this game as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. So back in, I think it was June, maybe July. I think it was June of 2015. I did a Kickstarter for Neptune Flux, and I was asking for $8,000, raised $10,000, and yeah, it went pretty well. It was a month long, but I like to say it was like the longest 4 months of my yeah. life.
Yeah.
We've never run one, but we hear they're just insane amounts of work. I mean, you're getting money, yeah. which is great, but I hear it's just, you know, it's super stressful, and the amount of work that goes into actually pulling off a successful Kickstarter is supposed to be unparalleled, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have kids, but the way that people talk to me about kids, I feel like is the same way that I talk to people about a Kickstarter, where I'm like, you know, it's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
Yeah. We can relate.
Oh my gosh. It was just an insane amount of work. And every day I'd you know, I knew how much money I wanted to raise. Right. And so, mm-hmm. you could divide that up into the number of days remaining in the campaign. And each day I could say, well, this is my daily goal. And if I didn't hit that goal, then the next day that goal would be even higher,
right?
It would just be even harder if I didn't hit that goal. So every day I was like, well, today I gotta find $200 somewhere. I don't know. And you never know where that's going to come from. My advice on Kickstarter would be just like, don't do it if you can avoid it.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a lot of times it's kind of unavoidable. I think for my project, it's probably the only way realistically that it was going to happen, because there were a lot of expenses that were incurred. In fact, like, it really just defrayed the cost of it. It didn't really cover the cost of it completely.
Right. Right.
Is a crazy amount of work for what it is. And I guess the upshot though, is that you get fans out of it, right? You connect directly with the people that are really invested with in your idea.
Yep.
And so that was definitely cool to see people that liked those kinds of games and wanted to see another one of those games get made.
Nice. And actually, I want to give you kudos for this Kickstarter, because we've all participated in Kickstarters in the past and have, you know, spoken to other developers that have run them as well. And what I thought was really awesome about yours is not only did you get your game out on time, but you also probably wrote some of the most clear and honest progress updates for Kickstarter that I've seen from any project. And I guess in the interest of full disclosure, I did back your project, but I was just really impressed with how sort of on top of that you were, and the fact that you even got the game out when you said you were going to, because that's kind of a rarity. Yeah. On Kickstarter for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you should definitely caveat that, because I barely got it out on time. So like the game came out. Yes. Some of the rewards are behind. The PlayStation version got delayed. I mean,
things happen for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it came out, when I said it was going to come out, I was pretty determined to make that happen, because I experienced the same thing with a lot of Kickstarters too. I back a lot of games on Kickstarter, and I, saw that same thing happening, and I was determined to not be another one of those statistics.
Like 2 weeks ago, I got a backer reward from something that came out, I think, 2.5 years ago.
Man.
The game has been out for 2.5 years.
It's painful.
I finally got, I was like, got something in the mail. I was like, what is this? I was just like, I remember this game. it was old news.
Man,
yeah,
that's amazing. That's real dedication there. I'm actually impressed they didn't just kind of like forget about it. But no, I mean, that just goes to show you that stuff keeps you up at night. I'm sure for the past 2 years, they were like, man, I got to mail out those stickers. Oh my gosh. Like,
yeah,
absolutely.
Thinking about it.
For sure. Well, speaking of dedication, let's talk about being, you know, a development team of one. Obviously, you've, you know, there were some, you know, people that helped along the way in terms of music and some, you know, support in other areas, but like, you know, you largely are the development team. So how do you keep yourself motivated to go through this process? And, you know, obviously you had to get up every day and go like, all right, well, I need to mail the stickers out, but I also need to continue modeling these objects and doing other things too. So how did you make all of that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you kind of just have to be crazy to do it.
Sure.
I mean, you have to really like the idea, like to an irrational degree. I mean, I thought long and hard about whether or not I wanted to make a game, you know, why I was doing that in the first place. And then I thought a lot about what kinds of ideas I might pursue. I mean, you really have to think through like all the different alternative scenarios and make sure that that is definitely the thing that you want to do, because you're going to be stuck with it for a long time. And, yeah. And for me, and I think this is true of most game developers, you have a lot of ideas along the way that you have to put aside. And you know, I had tons of ideas that I really want to pursue, and I guess pretty soon I'll be able to, but oh my gosh. Yeah. it's really hard to stay focused. And for that reason, you know, you have to be in love with the idea that you choose up front. But yeah, balancing everything wasn't too hard, because really I could only work on one thing at a time. I guess split my focus as much as it might seem. You know, I would work on just one area of the game for a little while, or I would take a weekend and I'd say, okay, this weekend, like I really need to get on top of like optimization or marketing or the Steam page. Like, you know, just there'd be these things that would just go unaddressed for like weeks and weeks, and be like, okay, I finally really have to do this. Like right now for Kickstarter, it's t-shirts. Like I need to send out t-shirts. I said I'd send them out before the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's approaching pretty quickly, so I'd better do that, you know.
Yeah.
And same with the PlayStation port. I mean, that's actually why I haven't like gotten on the t-shirts, because it's kind of like, well, I can get the game on PlayStation and make a lot of people happy, or send out t-shirts on time to like I think it's 30 or 40 people, right? So
yeah,
it is a balancing act, but I think
the fact that you're doing it all yourself is crazy to me, though, because I've worked in development before, and seeing the number of people that do, you know, there was a person to just do the t-shirts, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like the fact that you're doing everything and you're putting it all together is just really admirable. And I think it's amazing that you pulled it off and the game is out. I mean, that is just like, you know, creating something with a huge team is one thing, but creating something that is this beautiful on your own must just feel great.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is nice to have it out. And I should say that I'm not the only person that worked on this. I mean, I mostly did it by myself, but I definitely had collaborators, like Scott mentioned. I had a buddy of mine work on the music, and his name's Chris Zabriskie. He put out the album onto a couple places. I know it's out on SoundCloud and iTunes, and I think it'll be out on Spotify and a couple other places pretty soon. But yeah, I mean, he created this amazing score for the entire game, and I'm blown away by the work that he did.
Absolutely.
I had a friend of mine in Los Angeles. He's actually been my best friend for like the past, gosh, I think 15, 20 years now. And he's a screenwriter in LA, and he helped me make the dialogue gooder.
Yeah, right.
Not bad. You know, I basically approached him with a basic story concept, and I was kind of like, you know, I think this is kind of the direction I'm going to go. And he gave me some notes. And so throughout the whole process, he was super helpful in refining that. And towards the end, we had a couple of Skype sessions where we would just go through the entire script and make sure everything was tracking and everything made sense. And that was a pretty difficult part of it for sure. So I'm glad I had help there. Mm. But yeah, and then I had a sound engineer and voice actors.
Well, this is actually a good segue into setting the tone for the game, because that's something that we want to talk about as well. So why don't we talk a little bit about the what the inspiration for the atmosphere, the tone of the game was, and how you sort of arrived at the story that you presented within the game. How did you set this whole tone? Even from choosing something like doing underwater as opposed to doing it on a space station, which seems to be more kind of like like in style right now, but like that's kind of the first thing that I was taken with your game, which I got into and I was like, wow, this is underwater. This is interesting. You don't see a lot of stuff like this that takes place, in the deep sea, and that, this onto itself is sort of an interesting premise even without anything else. So how did you sort of craft all the, things that make the game what it is?
Sure. So I think actually the genesis of the setting came from the technical challenges of virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple, I set out with a few things that I really wanted to do. I really wanted to make a game where you could go anywhere, and basically an open world game where you could do things in any order that you wanted and go in any direction. But VR, that's pretty difficult to do.
Right.
Because there's a whole challenge of locomotion, right? And every game is solving it in a different way.
And so you knew from the start that this was going to be a VR release as well, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I guess I didn't mention that part. So I knew I wanted to make a video game. Mm-hmm. This was actually my New Year's resolution back in December 2013.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Nice. So here we are 3 years later, right? I had like all these different ideas, like I always do. And I kind of wanted to try to include as many of them as possible.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And they're so, like, the deep sea is one of the most unexplored places on the planet. It is the most unexplored place on the planet.
Right.
And when I started thinking about that, I was like, it's really a place where anything is possible or plausible. There's stories about lost shipwrecks and Atlantis and the Bermuda Triangle. It's filled with all these kind of weird X-Files type mysteries. And that's when I started to think, this could make sense as a story where I can tie together a lot of interesting set pieces into something that's cohesive.
Exactly. I think that kind of nails it perfectly. And I think what adds a lot of sort of vibrancy and life to that story is the voice acting. And you actually chose to go out and find voice actors to kind of, bring some life to the characters in the game, right?
Yeah. So doing this game by myself meant that there was a lot of scoping decisions I had to make.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I say the game is like Gone Home or Firewatch because it's not a long game. There's no way I was going to make 60, 100 hours of content like Skyrim or something, right?
Right, right, right.
So it is a short game. And then another thing I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do is character animation. As just like, there's no way I'm going to animate, dozens of characters and NPCs and stuff. Mm-hmm. But
plus you're under the ocean, like at the bottom of the ocean.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, but I was like, I still want to tell this, some kind of a story. So how can I do that? And I saw, this was right around the time actually that a couple of those adventure games were really picking up on Steam, Firewatch in particular, mm-hmm. but several others as well. I think Abduction was one of them too. I saw coming up and I saw that they were doing a lot with just voice acting. And I also played through Her Story at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that was a really amazing game. I mean, they didn't do just voice acting. They had full motion video, of course. But I saw that. I was like, wow. So you really can tell a story in a game like this where really most of them don't have much character animation to speak of at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, that's, people will buy that. That's plausible. You don't have to have character animation, but I knew that the voice acting had to be really, really good. So not a lot of people know this about me, but growing up, I was actually a child actor. So from ages two to 18, I was a child actor.
That's awesome.
The thing that I like to tease is when I turned 19, did I just become an adult actor, or was I just a regular actor?
Right.
Or did I just stop acting?
Right.
That's a really bad joke.
No, that's hilarious.
So I was a child actor, and so I had gone to tons of auditions in Orlando. Like I grew up in Tampa Bay area.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's where I'm from as well. Yeah.
My mom would drive me over to Orlando because that's where all the auditions were. This was in like the heyday of like Nickelodeon. And
oh man.
Oh yeah. We remember.
Disney Channel and stuff like that. You know, like this, and Orlando, if it wasn't being shot in Hollywood, is being shot in like New York or Orlando. So a lot of that is still here. There's tons of acting talent still in Orlando. There's tons of film and theater talent in Orlando. And I knew that, and I was like, okay, well, I could go online and try to do this remotely, or I could just find a studio here and find some really great actors in the area, and be able to work with them in a very direct way. And to me, that was important, to be able to direct them in person and really into the emotions that I knew we needed to get across. So I posted a casting call on a couple of different local boards, and I got something like 300 or 400 responses. It was a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, and most of them came in like the first 2 days, and I was just like, whoa.
Oh my gosh, that must have been overwhelming.
So I had some office space downtown that a friend was nice enough to let me use for the auditions, and I had it for 2 days, a Saturday and a Sunday. And I knew that there was no way I was going to be able to see that many people. So really the audition process started in my inbox. Like kind of sucks, right? Cause I'm just, you know, you want to see as many people as you can. So I narrowed it down to 60, and I saw 60 people over 2 days. And I ended up choosing 5 of them, and we recorded, I think, over 3 sessions. Yeah, and it was super fun. I got a friend of mine to help out with the audio engineering, because that is her forte, and definitely not mine. And yeah, it was just super great seeing the script come to life and the actors make a lot of the dialogue sound, a lot of the cheesy lines actually sound good.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, I think you did a really awesome job in the selection of the voice actors that you picked. I feel like they, you know, pretty much perfectly capture the essence of what is in the game, which I think is really awesome. And like you said, you know, I didn't realize that everybody was, you know, local more or less. And, it just feels very professional, like the way that the voice acting is portrayed in the game, which I think is really awesome. And voice acting is something that's really, interesting and important to us on this show. So it's really awesome that you, spend so much effort in making sure that you got that part of the game right. The two main characters, specifically, I really feel like, capture the tension of like what's happening, throughout the game. So I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing. So there's the two main characters are Sarah and the Aqua Commander.
Yeah.
And so you take on the role of Sarah, and Sarah kind of has this troubled past. She basically starts the game and she's pretty dead inside. You know, she just wants to get back to work, forget about her problems. And the Aqua Commander is just this opposite character. Like, he's very happy and go get him, and he's just like really excited to be there. And at first, I didn't totally imagine the character that way. I kind of thought that it would be a little bit more authoritative and sinister. And then I heard the actor read for it. His name's Joey Maxwell. He's great. And like his name just sounds like a voice actor.
Yeah, Joey absolutely.
And he gave this read that was like, it was almost like the announcer voice you hear at like Disney World, yeah, on like the monorail or, yeah, something. Like, please keep your hands and arms inside. Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. Like,
that's like, perfect. He's like a character that you can't get mad at, but you just want to shake him. You want to be like, yeah, stop, yeah, telling me to do all this stuff, man. Get out of my face. Yeah.
Yeah. I heard that read and I was like, you know, that's not how I pictured it, but that's better than what I was thinking. So, we went with it and it turned out great.
Yeah. I'm really, it happy really fits that, like, you know, sci-fi dystopian kind of vibe that's going on in the game, which is really awesome. You know, since we did a Kickstarter and, you know, something I'm personally interested in is, you know, user research and feedback, like, let's talk a little bit about the role of, you know, how early access to the game kind of shaped, you know, the game. I remember originally there were some Let's Play videos that were posted by some streamers that you provided them the opportunity to play. So how did some of the early feedback help in ultimately shaping the finished product in the game?
It helped a lot. You know, at Bethesda Softworks, so the people that make Skyrim, mm-hmm, and Fallout, they have a saying that great games are played, not made. And I tried to take that philosophy to heart as much as I could, because as soon as I started getting people in front of Neptune, which is like basically as early as I could,
yep,
I started to understand what that saying really meant, is that you have no idea what the real problems are in your game until people actually play it. And the things that I thought were going to be important turned out to not really be important at all. Right. And, you know, the things that people tended to focus on a lot, I realized that, wow, okay, that's, you know, those are things that I need to address. And, you know, it's the typical things like the, you know, like the controls, or originally the game was really, really dark, not thematically, but just like actually dark, like you couldn't, mm-hmm, see. And so that was something I had to also come to terms with, because the deep sea is a very dark place. There's no natural sunlight.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so, so I was like, well, you know, I guess it is a video game, so I can push this stylistically really as much as I want to.
I remember people asking like, where are the fish? And you're like, well, hold on a second. You know, like, it's the, right, bottom of the ocean. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, there's a very different life that lives at the bottom of the sea. And so it was definitely a learning experience from day one. And I think as the game got further and further along, you know, I was able to refine more and more things, and new problems would come up that, you know, now that the game was at like some new level or some new bar, suddenly things that weren't really important to people before would become important. And, mm-hmm, that was certainly interesting as time went on. But yeah, I think in the late stages, some of the data that I collected actually through Unity Analytics was the most helpful, because I did a beta for Kickstarter backers. Right. So about 100 people played that. And I got some pretty good qualitative feedback through a Steam user group.
Mm-hmm.
That was really helpful. And actually, one of the things that I ended up including in the game from that feedback was compass markers.
Oh, so yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
I had a compass in the game. and people kept asking for a map. And it's just like, I'm not going to put a map in the game.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, every game has a map, I feel like. And
yes, sometimes in diagnosing a piece of feedback, you need to try to figure out, like, is it really what they want is a map, or are they just providing a solution to a problem that they're having? And maybe you can come up with a different solution that still meets that problem.
Exactly.
That's the balance you're treading as you're trying to balance the vision for your game, you know, along with like what, you know, players' expectations are, what their experiences with the game. I feel like that's really difficult to do. It must be.
Totally. Yeah. Because, you know, putting in a map would completely take away from the exploration, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that. So, because like Myst, that doesn't have a map, and the whole fun of it is just figuring it out.
Yeah. Getting lost, like exploring, finding things. Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, I mean, and for some people that's not fun, and that's fine, because you're right. I know a lot of people enjoy that type of thing, and I'm one of them. I mean, that's really a big reason why I made this game. And so I was like, well, I'm not going to put it in a map. And what, and that's a, like you were saying, I came back to, well, what are they really asking for here? And I think the thing that was troublesome was that they just kind of felt like they were getting lost too easily.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because there's a fine line between mystery and confusion, right?
Right.
And so you want to keep that air of mystery without kind of piercing the veil and turning it into this just confusing mess. And that's a hard thing to do. So I ended up just adding compass markers. So even if you felt like you got kind of lost or off track, you could still turn around and say, okay, well, relative to where I am now, where's like the base, or where?
Yeah, you can always find your way back home. Like in the release. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, yeah. We're just about out of time. So let everybody know one more time where they can find the game, where they can connect with you and follow your updates and all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. So I am at NickRP on Twitter. So just NickRP. It's my middle initial and last initial at the end there, because I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
Nick was taken.
Yeah, right.
And the game is Neptune Flux, and it's out now on Steam, and it will be coming to PlayStation 4 sometime early next year.
Awesome. Well, thanks.
Yeah. Congratulations,
thanks,
man.
Nick, for being on the show. Congrats on the game. Congrats on doing the Kickstarter and getting the, you know, the PC game out when you said you were going to, which is really awesome. And we wish you all the best, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep,
thanks for coming on.
All right, cheers.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to episode 252 of the Rated NA Podcast. As always, you can find us on Twitter, and that's at NerdAppropriate. Please say hi to us there. You can email us directly. That's Matt, Scott, Ash, and nerds at nerdappropriate.com. Send an email any of those places, and we will write you back. You can find us most places under Nerd Appropriate. We have Twitch TV. We have Instagram. We've got Facebook. Just do a search for Nerd Appropriate. We also have an Xbox Club. So if you do a search for Nerd Appropriate on Xbox Live, we have a club there with a bunch of members, and we're going to be doing some stuff with our community there. We did some Titanfall 2 with community pals the other day. We'll probably do that again.
Like to keep and doing stuff like that. It's a lot of fun.
It is really, really fun. And special thanks, of course, to Nick Pettit for coming on the show and talking about Neptune Flux. Super fun game, so check it out, especially if you are into VR.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I had a VR headset.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, should mention it's also not VR as well. You can play it however you'd like, but
I want to play it in virtual reality.
In virtual reality, which is probably the best way to play it.
He should have made an apparatus that's USB that when bad things happen in the game, it squirts you with water.
as if your submersible is
you got a leak and you're submersible and your VR headset's on and all of a sudden you're just getting spritzed. You know?
I'm
telling you, maybe it's the future of VR.
We'll ask him if that's possible.
He can probably make it. He made the whole damn game himself.
You're right.
He can make a spritzer, a USB spritzer.
Fair enough.
All right. We'll be back next week with some all new stuff. And take care, guys.
Have a good week.
Yeah. Bye.
Are we ready to go? Did I talk about Skate 3 on episode 251?
You said you were playing it.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, I'll talk about it for real this time.
Okay.
You know, because it's new and current.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I was going to say, like, 8 years old.
A full review of Skate 3 for us.
Yeah, let me just add it down to the review section here. Yeah, for sure.